From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, bluegrass star Earl Scruggs. He celebrated his 80th birthday this week. Scruggs perfected the three-finger picking technique that became standard in bluegrass. His hit with guitarist Lester Flatt, Foggy Mountain Breakdown, was used on the soundtrack of the movie Bonnie and Clyde. Also actor Adrian Brody. He won an Academy Award for his starring role in The Pianist, now out on DVD. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Monster, the new feature about Florida serial killer Eileen Wuornos, and the documentary Eileen, Life and Death of a Serial Killer. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The government was out with a disappointing jobs report today. The Labor Department said payroll growth was virtually non-existent last month, although the unemployment rate fell. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Unemployment fell from 5.9 to 5.7%, but the government said that was mainly because the labor force shrank, and that happened in part because a lot of discouraged workers have quit searching for jobs and aren't technically on the unemployment rolls anymore. Altogether, U.S. payrolls grew by just 1,000 in December. That was well below what most economists had predicted. Manufacturing employment shrank for the 41st straight month, and retail hiring was also down. All this occurred despite numerous signs that the U.S. economy is improving. But the weak report raised new questions about the strength of the recovery, and stock prices fell sharply. Jim Zeroli, NPR News.
Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge announced today that the federal government is lowering the terror alert level from orange, or high risk of attacks, to yellow, which indicates an elevated risk. Ridge says an urgent threat over the holidays has passed. He says the increased security prevented attacks.
We believe this is a testament to the incredible level of awareness, information sharing, and communication that stretch across the country and around the world.
Ridge says certain locations and sectors of the economy, which he didn't identify, will remain at the orange alert level. A Saudi graduate student in Idaho has been indicted on charges of using his computer skills to aid terrorism. The student has been detained for a year since federal agents arrested him in a high-profile raid at the University of Idaho. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The raid last year first led to charges of visa fraud, and Sami al-Hussein is scheduled to go on trial for that later this month. The new charges are far more serious. U.S. attorneys say al-Hussein set up a dozen websites for Islamic groups that recruit and raise money for holy war or jihad. One posting by al-Hussein himself allegedly called on Muslims to fight the idolater with your money, your tongues, and your prayers. The U.S. is investigating several of the charities al-Hussein worked for. The indictment also charges al-Hussein with conspiracy, alleging that he tried to hide his computer assistance. Al-Hussein's lawyer denies his client's guilt. He says the latest indictment contains no new information and questioned why the charges weren't brought earlier. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
The Pentagon says ousted Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is being held as an enemy prisoner of war. A spokesman says Saddam has been treated according to the rules of the Geneva Convention ever since his capture, but this is the first time his status has been officially defined. In stocks, the Dow lost 133 points to close at 10,458. This is NPR News. U.S. officials in Iraq say a bomb killed at least 5 people and injured 37 today outside a Shiite Muslim mosque in the central Iraqi town of Bakuba. Police in the town say they discovered more than 300 pounds of explosives in a car parked in front of another mosque nearby. That bomb apparently malfunctioned and failed to go off. Attacks on mosques have become more frequent in recent weeks as Sunni and Shiite factions struggle for power. A top executive suspected of involvement in the multi-billion-dollar Parmalat fraud scandal turned himself in to Italian authorities today. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Parma, Italy.
Giovanni Bonici, head of Parmalat's Venezuela branch, entered the Parma courthouse today from a back door. Bonici is wanted in connection with his activities as the former chairman of a Parmalat subsidiary in the Cayman Islands that's at the center of the company's bankruptcy. Last month, Parmalat acknowledged that the subsidiary did not have the $5 billion it claimed was in a Bank of America account. In other developments today, Italian financial police searched Bank of America's Milan offices. Yesterday, prosecutors added to their list of 24 suspects a former Bank of America employee. Parmalat founder Callisto Tanzi, who's in jail in Milan, has admitted to a $10 billion shortfall. But the scandal has spread beyond Italy and could implicate numerous international banks. Silvio Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 13 points today to close at 2,086. For the week, though, the Nasdaq gained 4%. The S&P 500 lost 10 points to close at 1,121. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Earl Scruggs, one of the most important banjo players in the history of bluegrass, celebrated his 80th birthday Tuesday. President Bush and Dolly Parton were among those who sent greetings. Scruggs perfected the three-finger style of banjo picking that became standard for bluegrass musicians. In 1945, Scruggs met guitar player Lester Flatt while they were playing in Bill Monroe's band. They left to form their own group in 1948. Flatt and Scruggs became one of the most popular acts in country music. Their hit Foggy Mountain Breakdown became even more famous when it was used on the soundtrack of the movie Bonnie and Clyde. They also crossed over by playing the theme for the TV series The Beverly Hillbillies. Lester Flatt died in 1979. Scruggs has been inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, and last year he got his own star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Terry Gross spoke with Earl Scruggs last fall after the release of the CD The Three Pickers, where he performs with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs. Let's start with a track. This is Feast Here Tonight.
As a remedy in a log and ain't got my dog, how will I get him? I know. I'll get me a briar and I'll twist in his hair. That way I'll get him, I know.
Earl Scruggs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, you grew up during the Depression. Your father died when you were four. How did your family make a living when he died?
He was a farmer also. So I stayed on the farm until I got old enough to get a job in the factory. And on the farm, you work from daylight till dark. And in the factory, you work 8 hours. So I thought that was great.
Right. Who did you hear play banjo before you started playing yourself? I mean, I've read that there was no radio in your house when you were growing up.
No.
So who did you hear? How did you hear them?
We had a banjo in our home. My father played the old-style banjo, so I had a banjo there, and my brother Horace had a guitar, and so we just started playing just old tunes that we'd heard before, and then a little later we got a Sears Roebuck radio and started listening to some, mainly the Grand Ole Opry and some programs like that. But as far as the style banjo that I play, nobody had played it before me. And the only thing that is different from my playing from what I'd heard is I had a three-finger roll, later been called Scruggs style. But it seemed to help me to play slow tunes as well as up-tempo tunes. Most of the banjo playing in the old days were hoedown type tunes, up-tempo tunes.
So could you put into words what your style of picking is, the three-finger style?
Well, it's just what you hear. It involves it's a little misleading, say, three fingers. It's actually two fingers, middle and index finger, and your thumb. And it's a kind of, some of the rolls will go, if you number your thumb one, the index two, and your middle finger three, it's like a 1-2-3 roll over and over. But to do a tune, it's like trying to say every word with the same same amount of syllables in the word. You've got to alternate the roll some to make the tune flow.
Since you didn't have a radio when you were very young and you didn't have a record player,
yeah.
So you're just like hearing, you know, musicians who may have been, you know, living where you were. How did you come up with your style of playing, with your style of picking?
I guess the old days, you have one main room you have, you take company to when they come, that you don't use every day. So I was in what we call the front room with a banjo one day, and I was in a mode where if somebody had asked me what was I thinking about, and I bet you've been in that mode yourself, you couldn't tell them what you was thinking about. You was just kind of sitting there. And I was picking the banjo, and I was playing a tune that's still played today called Reuben. And when I realized what I was doing, I was playing the way that I play now. It was just like having a dream and wake up, you was actually playing the tune. So that was the mode I was in and what I was doing when I learned exactly what I'm doing today.
So did you think like, oh my God, this is a breakthrough, or did you just not make, you know, think much of it at the moment?
Well, my brother said, I came out of the room saying, I got it. So I didn't know what I had, but he said that's what I was saying. But anyway, I played to play Reuben. It's tuned in a different key from standard tuning, and I played that one tune the rest of the week, and my oldest brother, Junie, came over on Saturday. He came walking up the road, and then I got out on the edge of the porch and started playing Reuben, and as he started going to the house, he said, is that all you can play? And that shocked the fire out of me, because I hadn't retuned the banjo to another key and tried another tune.
Now, you joined Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys in 1945. This was the group that basically created the sound that's become known as bluegrass. When you joined the band, could you hear that something different was happening there?
Oh, yeah. Nobody had had this style of banjo in the group, and he just did the type tunes that would make the banjo sound good. So it was a good shot to start with, because he had Grand Ole Opry exposure, and that gave me a lot of exposure when I went to work with him. And it got immediate attention, because nobody had heard that kind of a banjo picking. So it caught on real fast with the public.
Why don't we hear one of your recordings with Bill Monroe from 1947. This is one of the famous ones, Bluegrass Breakdown, with Bill Monroe on mandolin, Lester Flatt, guitar, my guest Earl Scruggs, banjo, recorded in 1947. Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, recorded in 1947 with my guest Earl Scruggs on banjo. You're considered one of the first banjo players to be a serious musician and to not be a comic with a banjo. A lot of banjo players before you would tell comic monologues or sing comic songs with banjo accompaniment. And in fact, there's a story that may be apocryphal that Uncle Dave Macon, the banjo player, said after hearing you the first time, he ain't one damn bit funny. Did you realize that you were a departure from that, a departure from the kind of comic tradition of banjo playing?
I used to try to study to see if it's some kind of routine I wanted to do as being a comedian, because every banjo player, and there were very few, but they all were comedians, and kind of used the banjo as a prop to get into their comedy routine. But all my interest was just in picking not only tunes, but songs behind singers, not only in the lead part, but doing a backup. You know what I mean by backup? Mm-hmm. Playing an alto or something to support the singer. So that's where my interest was as a lead picker with the banjo, but also a supporter with the banjo.
What was life on the road like with Bill Monroe?
It was terrible. If I hadn't been 21 years old and full of energy, just came off in a farm and a thread mill where I could, you know, I thought to do an hour show on the road was a pushover compared to 8 hours in the mill or from sunup to sundown on the farm. And music was my love, so to get into a group that had good singing and playing, and Bill had that, especially good singing and had good fiddle player. So I went in, and it just seemed to make a full band, especially for that style of music. That was long before anybody had tagged it as bluegrass. It was just country music, but it really made an outstanding group for that day and time, especially.
But why did you hate traveling so much with the band?
Why did I hate it?
Mm-hmm.
It was because we did it 24 hours a day, practically. Back then, there was only two-lane highways, and he traveled in a 41 Chevrolet car. And we'd leave after the opera on Saturday night and maybe work down in South Georgia about as far as you could get for a Sunday afternoon show, and on down to Miami someplace for Monday or Tuesday, and work till about Thursday and start working back to Nashville. So it was just, you'd only be in Nashville long enough to do the Grand Ole Opry and to get a change of clothes and pack your suitcase and head out again. I was single at the time, so I was living in a hotel and had one suitcase. And I had to really work on it to keep clean clothes for every night doing a show on the road.
Earl Scruggs speaking with Terry Gross. He turned 80 this week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Oft I sing for my friend.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with banjo player Earl Scruggs, one of the pioneers of bluegrass music. When we left off, they were talking about playing with Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys in the mid-40s.
Now, it was in the Bill Monroe band that you met guitarist Lester Flatt, who became your long musical partner. What were your first impressions of him when you first heard him play and sing?
Well, I liked his singing, and his playing fit in good with that style of music. And we palled around together, you know, in a group. You kind of find one or two guys that you like better than the other part of the group, or the other maybe interesting things that you don't care for. So anyway, Lester and I got along with each other and roomed together, and so we did that for 2.5, 3 years, and that's when, really, we never had talked about starting a show ourselves, but I had made up my mind that I was going to just get off on the road. So I worked 2 weeks' notice, and when I started to leave that night, Lester turned in his notice. And while he was working his notice, he gave me a call over in North Carolina and said, why don't we get on the radio station over close to your home and try it as a group ourselves. So that's how we got started with the Foggy Mountain Boys.
Now, you started recording. You and Lester Flatt started recording in, I think it was 1948. And for the first couple of years, you recorded for Mercury Records.
Uh-huh, yeah.
During that period, you recorded what became one of your best-known songs, Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yeah.
Is there a story behind the song?
Well, it's just a simple song that I probably wrote in 10 or 15 minutes. And I've written several other tunes and had some pretty big hits, but nothing like Foggy Mountain Breakdown. You'll have a ringer, as I call it, one that might make a hit with just about everybody. And so Foggy Mountain Breakdown was one of them. And it got a lot of support, like in the film Bonnie and Clyde movie. They used it as a chase song, and that supported that tune a lot. So the tune did a lot for not only me, but it did a lot for a situation like that in a movie, like Bonnie and Clyde.
How did Foggy Mountain Breakdown end up being used in the movie Bonnie and Clyde?
He called and wanted me to write a tune for them.
Who called?
Warren Beatty,
mm-hmm.
who wrote and starred in the show. And so he called back. I think I'm quoting this exactly the way it was, in a few days, and he said he didn't want me to write anything because he'd found a tune that he thought fit what he wanted. See, we recorded that tune before they got what I say good equipment. I mean, just plain everyday microphones and a radio station and no to start making tunes sound fuller or something. It was just raw material. Well, that, I mean, it didn't have no echo chamber or anything on it. So that's what Warren Beatty heard in that tune. So he didn't want to try to record another tune because he thought that the equipment that they had then was probably would give it a more modern tune than what we had recorded, which turned out to be Foggy Mountain Breakdown and the sound that we got then.
So you're saying that he used the original recording and he didn't want you to re-record it?
Yeah. He took the Mercury recording and that was it.
Why don't we hear that original recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown? And this is Lester Flatt and my guest, Earl Scruggs. Original recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, which was later used in Bonnie and Clyde, featuring Lester Flatt on guitar, Earl Scruggs on banjo. My guest is Earl Scruggs, and his latest CD is called Three Pickers, and it features him, Doc Watson, and Ricky Skaggs performing together. Now you mentioned when you got off the road with Bill Monroe, what you wanted to do was a radio show, and first you did one in Bristol. Then mm-hmm. in 1953, you ended up doing a radio show in Nashville at a station there. And
WSM, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, I think, a 15-minute program every morning at 5:45, which is pretty darn early to have to perform.
We'd come in 2 o'clock and go to bed and get up at 4 to try to get awake enough to do a live radio program. But that was your bread and butter in those days. By that, I mean we made our living by the road work that we did. We'd go out and do shows and charge admission and get a percentage of that and also some flat rate, too. But that just put us to working in better,
the show,
bigger auditoriums and bigger crowds.
The show is sponsored by Martha White Flower.
Yeah.
And I understand the jingle for that became pretty well known, and you were even requested to play it at some of your concerts. I've never heard it. How did it go?
Now you bake bright with Martha White, goodness gracious, good and light, Martha White, for the finest biscuits, cakes, and pies. It's Martha White, self-rising flour. And the group says, the one all-purpose flour. Get Martha White, self-rising flour. It's got hot rise. Hot rise was actually a baking soda that went into the bread that would, it makes bread rise. You know that yourself, being a lady. So, but I thought it was pretty cleverly written.
So did you get like a lifetime supply of free Martha White flour?
Oh, no. Oh, no. They would probably have done that, but I got a lifetime of work with Martha White. It's a great company, and they helped us just more than I could total up, I guess.
How long did that show last?
Oh, I wish my wife was in here. She could tell you better than me, but it lasted for a lot of years, and we went into television. Television came in about 1955, so they put us, we started transcribing the morning show, radio show, and we'd sleep late, but we'd have to do a live television show at a different city each night. And the reason I say a live radio, television, that was before they had cameras to film you with, so we'd leave 4 o'clock Monday morning to go to down in Georgia. Had two cities in Georgia, Atlanta being one, and let's see, Wednesday was Florence, South Carolina, and Thursday was Huntington, West Virginia, and Friday was Jackson, Tennessee, down West Tennessee, and Saturday back at WSM television. And do the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. And if we weren't working on Sunday, we were free until 4 o'clock Monday morning, and we started that 2,500-mile tour again.
Earl Scruggs speaking with Terry Gross. Scruggs turned 80 on Tuesday. He plays with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs on the new CD, The Three Pickers. We'll have more of their interview in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This is one of your tunes, isn't it, Earl?
Yeah, it is.
It's called Pick Along. All right, Earl.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Carrie Scheider's American Yoga, The Paths and Practices of America's Greatest Yoga Masters, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Iron Fire, a novel of the Knights of Malta and the Last Battle of the Crusades by David Ball, author of Empires of Sand. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with bluegrass musician Earl Scruggs. Also, actor Adrian Brody. Last year he won an Oscar for his starring role in Roman Polanski's The Pianist. It's now out on DVD. And David Edelstein reviews a new feature film and a documentary about Florida serial killer Eileen Wuornos.
Yeah.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with bluegrass pioneer Earl Scruggs. He turned 80 this week. Scruggs created the three-finger style of picking that became standard in bluegrass. In 1948, he and guitarist Lester Flatt left Bill Monroe's band to form their own group, Flatt and Scruggs, which became one of the most popular acts in country music and had the crossover hit Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Well, I want to ask you about another crossover hit that you had. And this, of course, was the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies, the Ballad of Jed Clampett, which got you like the number one record on the country music charts. It crossed over to the pop charts. And, of course, it was on TV every week for years. And it's still on a lot in reruns. How were you asked to write the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies?
I didn't write the theme.
I mean, to record the theme, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wish my wife was in here because she does all my business things, and she could tell you exactly how it came about. But we had done a show.
Wait, let me stop you. She's in the control room listening to the interview, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we invite her in, and she could tell us the story about the phone call. How's that?
She's on her way in.
Okay,
so
great.
So just hold that question. She'll be in a little bit. Now, Louise, say something, see if she
can. Hello.
Oh, that's much better.
One, two, three.
Now I can hear you in my headphones, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is this Louise Scruggs?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, can you tell us the story about the phone call inviting your husband to record the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies?
Well, Mr. Paul Henning, who wrote and directed the Beverly Hillbillies show, called before it went on the air. He had written the show, and he called and wanted Earl and Lester to do the theme music, and I turned it down at first because of the word Beverly Hillbillies. I didn't know what connotation that was going to take with country people and didn't want to offend them. So he said, well, what the premise of this show is that the Beverly Hillbillies are going to always be outsmarting the city slickers. So anyway, we talked about that two or three times, and he ended up sending the film, the pilot, to Nashville for us to see. And after we looked at it, we thought, okay, that looks all right. So they went ahead and recorded it. And while they were doing the theme music, I said to Perry Botkin, who was a music director at the time, I think that would make a great single. And so I called Mr. Henning, and I said, what do you think if they about them recording that for a single for Columbia Records? And he said, I think it's a great idea. So I spoke to their A&R director, Mr. Don Law, who was doing their records at the time. And so they recorded it 3 weeks later. And then it was released in October, and December 8th, 1962, it hit number one in Billboard.
On the country chart?
Yeah, right. And then it was up in the pop chart, too.
Louise Scruggs, you handled the business end of Flatt & Scruggs. How did the theme song from the Beverly Hillbillies affect business for the band?
Well, I started getting, after the show started airing, I started getting calls for them for dates and concerts. And within about a month, I had them booked up for a year in advance.
Okay.
So what it did, actually, insofar as spreading country music, it helped country music, and it helped, well, in the banjo in particular, because Earl gets mail from people all over the world.
What'll happen, too, I might inject here, that if you do something that makes a big hit, it's going to help all country music in general. So I think it really helped everybody that was on the road because it made more people aware of country music, and you're not going to get it all yourself. So it put a lot of people on the road to making, playing bigger dates.
Well, Louise Scruggs, thank you for stopping in for part of the interview. We really appreciate it. Earl Scruggs, you're still there?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. So you and Lester Flatt do not sing on the theme at all, right?
No, we just did the music.
Just the music,
part.
Right? Good. Okay.
And Jerry Scoggins, a West Coast person, did the vocal on the theme that you hear on the Beverly Hillbillies. We did record it for Columbia Records, but that was later.
And when you recorded it, you sang it?
Lester did. Mm-hmm.
And why don't we hear the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies with Lester Flatt and my guest Earl Scruggs.
Listen to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. All that is black gold, Texas tea.
If you're just joining us, my guest is banjo player Earl Scruggs. Now, why did you and Lester Flatt split up?
Well, the biggest thing for me, see, I had three boys coming along. Gary, Randy, and Steve was my youngest boy. And they were good musicians. And as a matter of fact, Randy had been recording with Lester and me as far as the guitar work ever since he's 7 or 8 years old. So I just had a band in my home, and one of the biggest thrills a person will ever get is to go on stage with his children, especially if they're good musicians, and I'll have to brag on them, even though they are my boys. I thought some of the best musicians I'd ever played with, because they had grown up listening to me. They knew everything that I did and could play it. Plus, they knew younger people's material, new material, and still they kind of made it sound like they were a Scruggs boy when they played it. So it was a great outlet for me to start working with my boys.
Did you stay close with Lester Flatt, and what kind of terms were you on when he died in 1979?
We were friends. I just didn't see him that much because I was on the road so much and the direction we were going. And he, of course, he kept to show himself, and he worked as long as he was able to work, really. Yeah. So I always, and still today, though he's been dead for several years, I still have a warm spot in my heart and cherish the days that we worked and traveled together.
There is a Gibson banjo that mm-hmm. is named for you. It's called the Earl.
Yeah.
It has a portrait of you
yeah.
on it and your signature. Is it a lot of fun to have, you know, a banjo that's dedicated to you, that bears your name and likeness?
It is. And as a matter of fact, they're making five different models with my name on it, from the plain banjo, which they're all basically the same banjo. What runs up the cost is like gold plating and engraving and things of that nature.
Do you play one of those Gibsons, or do you play something else?
Well, yeah, I play a Gibson banjo.
Is it an Earl?
Well, basically it is. I'm playing a banjo that I've been playing since back in the late 40s, I guess, early 50s, but it's still basically, they're still making basically the same banjo they were making way back there.
When you say you're still playing the same banjo, do you mean it's literally the same instrument or that it's the same model?
Yeah. Same banjo.
Same banjo. So do you have to get mm-hmm. it, like, redone occasionally?
Well, the only thing you're going to wear out on the banjo is the head. The head is used to be skin, but now it's plastic. They will wear out on you, and the strings. Outside of that, you play one for 1,000 years unless you got it broken some way.
Now, what do you love so much about this banjo? Is it just a sentimental attachment, or is there something special about the sound?
Well, it produces the sound that my ear's looking for. Maybe I've just gotten used to it, but I like the sound that I get out of that particular banjo. I feel at home with it when I take it out of the case and start, you know, it's no, when you start with another instrument, they all have their feel, and playing the same instrument, you know what it's going to feel like when you take it out of the case and start to perform.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Been my pleasure.
Terry Gross speaking with Earl Scruggs last fall. Scruggs celebrated his 80th birthday Tuesday. Coming up, Terry's interview with Oscar-winning actor Adrian Brody. This is Fresh Air. Roman Polanski's film The Pianist is based on the true story of Władysław Szpilman, a Jewish pianist in Warsaw who survived the Holocaust by hiding from the Nazis in the ruins of the Warsaw Ghetto. The role of Szpilman was played by Adrian Brody, who won an Academy Award for his performance. In describing the portrayal of a man who is wasting away from a lack of food, warmth, human contact, and the chance to play music, Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein wrote, "This is a major performance by Adrian Brody. Brody lost 30 pounds from his already skinny frame. I don't think that torturing your body and mind and great acting go hand in hand. But in this case, you can feel as if you're watching someone actually suffer, and in that suffering, hit notes you've never heard before." The Pianist has just been released on DVD. Terry Gross talked with Adrian Brody about the film last fall.
How did Roman Polanski choose you for The Pianist? Was he familiar with your work?
I'm not sure how familiar he was. He knew of my work, but his casting director thought that I would be a good person to meet, and I was actually in Paris shooting Affair of the Necklace, and we sat down for coffee, and the only information that I had was that Roman was going to be doing this new film about a pianist who survives in Nazi-occupied Poland. And we sat down and we spoke and had a lovely time. And we met again, and he got a script to me, and we discussed it. And it was an incredibly challenging role. And even on the page it was challenging, but impossible to understand what an ordeal it would be to...
Oh, sure. Look, yeah. I have trouble watching Holocaust movies because you know what the characters are in for, and you know how horrible it's going to be. And, you know, in some ways you want to protect yourself from even living through it as a viewer watching a movie.
Right.
So even living through it as an actor, you know, must be pretty rough.
Well, there was a huge responsibility, I felt, because how does a young man from Queens who has not really experienced hunger on that level, mm-hmm. who has not suffered on a real level like that, truthfully portray these things and these emotions? And there are so many people who have experienced this firsthand and whose families have... whose lives have been permanently changed by these events, and it was also such a personal story for Roman, who had lived through these experiences himself.
How did you answer that question that you just posed? You know, how does like a young man from Queens who's never experienced anything close to that level of suffering, how do you convey in an honest way that experience?
Well, Roman helped me suffer. that was one thing. But I basically, before I left to do the movie, when I started the film, I understood that I had to experience a few key things and understand them well. One is loss,
mm-hmm.
and loss of comfort, and loss of safety and hunger. And so before I left, I gave up my apartment. I had a place in New York. Gave up my apartment, put whatever I had in storage, sold a bunch of things, sold my car, disconnected my phones, got rid of my cell phone. And I left. And I went to Europe for about 7 months with a few bags and my own keyboard. And when I got there, I had to do a crash diet because we shot in reverse chronology, and I had to lose a lot of weight because there was a physical transformation that was necessary, which also gave me a greater connection, not only to the understanding hunger, which made me understand the sense of emptiness and loss that I wouldn't have known. But I was practicing piano for 4 hours a day at that time, and interestingly enough, the piano playing was a perfect distraction from the hunger, which allowed me to identify with the music in a way that I had never really grasped before. And I should also say that Roman made it tough, he did make it tough in a sense, but he toughened me up in a way because he wouldn't tolerate any kind of what he would call as Hollywood actor behavior, which would, you know, essentially be asking for something like a piece of bread. That was intolerable, but he reminded me, you know, of what is important, and I admire him tremendously.
How much weight did you lose? I mean, you were already pretty thin by anybody's standards.
I lost 30 pounds. I'm 6'1". I went to 130.
Wow. Okay. So that's a lot. Did you ever ask yourself when you were making the movie, like, am I ruining my body? Am I breaking my body? Am I doing, like, irreparable harm for a role?
Yeah, it frightened me afterwards. It kind of became... I have a really strong willpower, and it's something that I am proud of. And it was kind of like an experiment that I was having with myself to see how thin I could get, which was the plan. It wasn't like, okay, 130 is a safe weight. It was like I really couldn't get below that. And, you know, it may have fluctuated below that or above that here and there, but I pretty much stayed at that weight for the time that I needed to stay there, and then I would gradually increase it because we would have to slowly shoot in reverse chronology, and it would slowly get thinner, so I would slowly gain weight, and then I had to gain a lot of weight at towards the end, and that was, yeah, it had an effect on me. But
what's the point of shooting in reverse chronology, of shooting the end of the movie first? It seems counterintuitive, yeah. Especially for a movie like this, where you're experiencing a constantly diminished life and you're in constant growing danger.
It basically comes down to what works for the production. You know, anytime I've done a film, it's usually your most difficult scenes come first. Your love scene comes first. Your death scene comes first.
Well, do you ever come out the other end and think, if I had only gone through this in chronological order, I would have played that ultimate scene differently?
Well, but the advantage in this film, I mean, part of the reason was they had to have seasons, and the war was at the bleakest moment was at winter, and we shot at winter time.
Mm-hmm.
And then spring in Poland is actually beautiful and becomes very green and lush. And that took place prior to the war to give it this kind of more serene, mm-hmm. happier environment. The advantage of shooting in reverse chronology was that I understood this man in a way that I wouldn't have understood playing a man who was extremely talented and lived a very normal, kind of happy, yet non... It wasn't very specific, his existence prior to that. you don't know what defines this human being. You don't know what he's capable of. And the challenge came later in trying to let go of all the kind of pain that I absorbed and tried to absorb and create a sense of lightness and stubbornness and hope of humanity. But I think it was completely advantageous to me to shoot in reverse chronology in hindsight.
Adrian Brody speaking with Terry Gross. He won an Academy Award for his performance in Roman Polanski's film The Pianist, which has just come out on DVD. Coming up, a review of two new films based on the true story of serial killer Eileen Wuornos. This is Fresh Air. The serial killer Eileen Wuornos was executed in the autumn of 2002 for killing six men. Wuornos is now the subject of two films, the drama Monster, starring Charlize Theron, and the documentary Eileen, The Life and Death of a Serial Killer, co-directed by Nick Broomfield. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of both films.
In the new movie Monster, the former South African model Charlize Theron pulls off the kind of transformation that wins golden statuettes. But it's Nick Broomfield and Joan Churchill's documentary, Eileen, Life and Death of a Serial Killer, that eats into your mind and makes you question your understanding of any infamous crime that's filtered through a tabloid sensibility. Monster, which is evocatively directed by Patty Jenkins, is the one you should see first. It opens with a monologue in which Wuornos recounts her girlish dreams of becoming the next Marilyn Monroe, while the audience observes the cruel reality: boys having sex with her and then hurrying away for fear of association. Next, we see the mousy lesbian Selby, played by Christina Ricci, sitting in a gay bar when Wuornos, now a roadside hooker, strides in. Ricci has the biggest eyes in movies, and they pop out of her head. So will yours. You'll spend the first few minutes searching for Theron under all that makeup. Some critics have expressed amazement that Theron can act at all, as if Cindy Crawford had just pulled off Madea. But she's always been a nervy performer. And more important than the impersonation here, Theron gets inside Wuornos' bizarre hopefulness in a way that makes you pull for her. Both Monster and Broomfield's documentary agree on a turning point in Wuornos' career, that she met up one night with a convicted sexual predator who handcuffed, tortured, and sodomized her, and that she killed him before he could kill her. Although she could have reported what happened, she had no faith in the justice system. And something had snapped. In Monster, Eileen projects her rage onto a series of men who pick her up along the interstate. She taunts them, accuses them of wanting to rape and murder her, then shoots them in an escalating fury. Here she is, defending her crimes to Ricci, who has become her frightened lover.
People kill each other every day. For politics, for religion, and their heroes. No, no, there's a lot of I can't do anymore, but killing's not one of them, and letting those bastards out there go and rape somebody else isn't either.
No, Lee, that was one man. They can't all have been bad.
You know me. You think I could do it otherwise? I'm not a bad person. I'm a real good person, right? So don't feel bad. It's life, Sal. People like me and you go down every day.
These are powerfully dramatized scenes, but a little clunky, with Warnos' accounts of her horrible past shoehorned into the dialogue. Monster ends with a cynical bit of narration and a crawl that gives you the date of Warnos' execution, which is the starting point for Eileen, the life and death of a serial killer, which begins with Broomfield traveling to Florida to testify at Warnos' appeal of her death sentence, on the grounds that her original lawyer was, to put it euphemistically, incompetent. Broomfield's 1992 documentary, The Selling of a Serial Killer, focused on Hollywood's attempt to snare the rights to Warnos' story and the impact of that money on Warnos' lawyer, ex-lover, and the cops. This time, he goes back to her Michigan hometown and puts names and faces to the events only clumsily recounted in Monster. The mother who abandoned her to an abusive grandfather, the boys who used and shunned her, the friends who can't believe how little they did when Warnos was thrown out of her house after giving birth to a baby and was forced to live in the woods. The emotional core of Eileen, of course, is the interviews with Warnos, who seems even more deranged than the character portrayed by Theron. It's her view that the police knew who she was after the first killing, but let her do six more because they knew she'd become America's first female serial killer, and they knew that Hollywood would come bearing money. Now she wants desperately to be executed. She comes off as a sick and unhappy woman who never got anything, and that makes you grieve more, not less, for her victims. The English Broomfield regards the Florida criminal justice system with dry irony. Asked as he's about to enter the prison if he has concealed cameras, he says, "No, only this rather large one." I found his point of view absolutely compelling. He is appalled that the state of Florida and its re-election-seeking governor, Jeb Bush, has no interest in examining Warnos, only making a show of her execution. And he turns a withering eye on movie production companies, which loom over the second part of Warnos' life like a giant vampire bat. Considering the warping influence of Hollywood, it's a miracle that Monster is as clear-eyed as it is.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, South African actor and playwright John Connie. He's appeared in many of Athol Fugard's dramas. He wrote and stars in the play Nothing But the Truth, now at Lincoln Center in New York. It's a post-apartheid drama inspired by his brother, a poet who was shot and killed by South African police in 1985. Join us for the next Fresh Air.